If you have finished your attendance sheets, I'll take them today. If you don't have them with you and want to turn them in to Sue or throw them into my box, that's fine too. Any preliminary questions or format questions about the exam? Just off topic here, for those of you relatively new to town, there is a something I always enjoy in the Christmas season. They do a Messiah sing-along at the First Presbyterian Church, which is downtown. It's on Sunday night, and the rehearsal starts at 5:30, and then they actually perform it at 7, and the Spokane Symphony Orchestra is up in front of on the altar, I guess, not on the altar, but on whatever that front part of the church is, so the people who are singing are right in front of them, and you're essentially right in the orchestra pit if you sing, it's just a great experience to do it. And so it's a great way to start exam week, at least I would recommend. So, okay, questions about mayhem and personal injury and wrongful death? Yes. Okay. Okay. Again, remember the problem that you're solving, which is, I know somebody injured me negligently, but I can't figure out who it was. Depending upon the facts, you may be able to use one or the other of those theories, or maybe some other besides that, but alternative liability is where you're essentially dealing from a full deck. You have all the people that could have caused the injury. You can show that they all acted negligently, and the only thing you're missing is the knowledge of which one of these people did the deed. So again, in Summers versus Tice, both hunters are firing in the plaintiff's direction, and we say, well, it has to be one of the two of these. Alternative liability does not work where you're not dealing from a full deck. So if there's a third person who might have caused the injury, you can't take advantage of alternative liability. Concert of action, on the other hand, doesn't require that you are dealing from a full deck. There may be a group of people that decide to have a snowball fight out in, you know, the courtyard or the area between two dorms. And so these people are busily heaving snowballs at each other, and some civilian gets caught in the crossfire and gets hurt. I can't identify all the people. I don't even know where this snowball came from. And I don't have all the people who participated in this, but I have two of the people that cooked up this idea. And if I can show that there was an agreement, that this was concerted, it wasn't just that a bunch of people happened to be throwing snowballs, they did so pursuant to some concerted action. Somebody had the bright idea, you build this fort over here, I'll build this fort over here, and we'll go at it. If there is an agreement, this concert of action, then I can impose liability on the people in essentially who are employees, as it were, agents of this collective. So alternative liability requires that you deal from a full deck, but doesn't require any advance agreement. I could show these two hunters were firing in the same direction, but neither of them knew about the other or had any prior contact with it. As it happens in the facts of Summers versus Tice, they went out hunting together, but that wasn't the basis of the liability. It was the fact that they both did a negligent thing, and it had to be one of the two of them that caused the injury. By contrast, again, concert of action doesn't require a full deck, but it does require that you show it was pursuant to some agreement. These people motioned at each other at the stoplight, or there was some other communication, maybe not a writing sufficient to satisfy the statute of frauds, but there is the establishment of an agreement. Again, as we looked at Sindel, the problem in Sindel was there never was any kind of agreement among the parties to engage in the conduct that was the cause of the plaintiff's harm. They all did the same thing, but they were more like Summers versus Tice in that they were all doing the same thing negligently that could have caused harm to the plaintiff. The reason, as you'll recall, you couldn't apply alternative liability was in Sindel we didn't have a full deck. We're missing a few players, more than a few, as it turns out. Other questions? Yes. Yes, it would be. Let's suppose that in addition to stopping at a number of bars, the driver who ran over the plaintiff went to a party where they had some designer drugs or some other mind-altering substance. Not the same activity, but you could argue, hey, it wouldn't have made any difference even if this person wasn't drunk. They would have been stoned. If they weren't stoned, they would have been drunk, So to the extent, again, the plaintiff says, I'm at risk of having the defendant use it against me, that there were so many sources of harm, in effect, that this particular defendant's bad action didn't affect the outcome. So it doesn't have to be the same activity, but the key part of it is that the plaintiff is worried, with some justification, that the defendant will use as an excuse or as an argument against liability, well, my conduct wouldn't have made a difference. The other people who acted negligently set enough stuff in motion here that it was likely to happen anyway, even if I had used reasonable care. Perhaps, for example, in a rear-end collision, again, I get hit from behind and that car throws my car into the car in front of me, but as it happens, I was going pretty fast, too, and I argued, gee, even if it weren't for me, the guy behind me would have shoved me into the plaintiff's car, and I similarly do the same thing. We each say, hey, both of us were out of control, and so even if we had used reasonable care, would have caused the same harm. So to the extent the plaintiff is worried about that, I've got a good case showing the defendants were negligent and, in effect, collectively, they did a lot that wound up causing my injury. But what I'm worried about is they were so good at doing this injurious conduct that each one of them will say, mine by itself made no difference in the ultimate outcome. Other questions? Yes. Yes. Well, again, I think more broadly would be the jurisdictional differences, for example, in how you define who is closely related. So you might have a jurisdiction that says, like California in that Ballinger case with a tram, the two people on a ski gondola, one of them gets gored by the equipment, and the other one observes this and is caught in this gondola with a badly injured person. No previous relationship. But the court decides, well, stuck in a gondola with this person, you know, bleeding all over you and in extremis and so forth, that's so strong in terms of not only present at the accident scene, couldn't get away from the accident scene, suffered this direct emotional shock and so forth. They said the fact that they weren't closely related is not an insuperable obstacle. We'll allow that case to go forward. Some other jurisdiction might say this only applies to relatives. No matter how closely bonded you may feel to some other, you know, person, your friend, your coworker, what have you, to the extent you want to recover for emotional harm as a bystander, you've got to show you're actually related. So, you know, again, that a jurisdiction might decide this is the only way or one of the ways we need to keep these kinds of claims from spinning completely out of control. Other jurisdictions might say, it's a general rule, but we're not inflexible on that point. So that's there. At each point where you look at the factors in Dillon versus Legg, at the scene of the accident, well, do you mean literally at the scene of the accident? How about if you get there right after the accident has occurred? What if you see it on TV? What if you're talking to somebody on their cell phone when this horrible thing happens? You know, again, playing with that variable and how explicitly you define the boundary, the criterion of whether it's a direct emotional shock or whether it's essentially a relationship kind of loss. So with each of these factors, you can just sort of, in kaleidoscopic fashion, just sort of keep rearranging things with different permutations, and that's what I would want to do on an exam is sort of eyeball the circumstance and say, wow, you know, is this the kind of claim where as a, you know, if I represent the defendant, would I be worried that this claimant would have a pretty good chance of a recovery, and the recovery could very well be substantial. Not only am I worried about causing a spinal cord injury to this person, I'm worried that the other people on the assembly line at the same time are going to step forward and say, we too want a recovery for this. Well, I would say all jurisdictions permit some kind of bystander claim, but they may limit it, again, to say you have to be related. You know, it has to be a legal relationship, spouse, child, parent, sibling. And you have to be actually at it. So in other words, you could define it in a very restrictive way, or you could define it as California did, essentially in a sort of floating fashion to say these are the things we care about, but we're not obsessed with any one of these factors, and we're not going to say that this is a sine qua non. It's something, you know, essentially persuade us is what California is more inclined to do rather than here are a bunch of rigid requirements. So again, the jurisdictional variation is not only in terms of its liberality, how far do you stretch the boundaries of these kinds of claims? It is with what degree of precision do you specify it must be A, B, and C, or do you simply say, hey, these are kind of guidelines for you to tell us about, but we're going to judge each case on its own merits without making any of these criteria be all and end all. Okay. Right. 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 The reason I'm guessing that I didn't talk about his claim as a bystander is because we hadn't gotten there yet in that particular semester. So if you go back and look at the front, as you take these past exams or use them as practice, make sure you look at the front page to see how far the coverage of that exam extends. So maybe we got through wrongful death and, you know, wrongful birth, wrongful life, but we didn't get as far as claims for bystanders or loss of consortium. If there is no such restriction, if I'd be puzzled as to why I didn't do that. Oh, I would definitely say. Now, his problem, he would have a problem there precisely because many jurisdictions would say, yeah, he's a bystander, but he's not related to her. He's just her boyfriend. So he has no legal standing. So some jurisdictions would say, can't do anything for you there. Whereas other jurisdictions would say, well, now, if you were claiming a loss of consortium claim, we do have a problem because that's only available to spouses and he's not her spouse. But if we're talking about a bystander claim, which is essentially the direct emotional shock, then we're more open to, as in Ballinger versus the tramway company, even though you're not necessarily related in any legal sense, for purposes of this accident, you were closely enough related through this accident such that we would say the same principles that we applied in Dillon versus Legg should apply to you as well. I don't know. Again, that's the part where jurisdictions have enough flexibility. The rules are sufficiently open-ended so that I don't know what a court would do in allowing or disallowing those kinds of claims. But I'd certainly raise it as an issue if I would strongly suspect if actually somebody can call that up, if they got their CD with them or whatever. Oh, you do? As a matter of fact, gee. Well, here's the... whew, boy, I was scared there for a moment. So this exam covers chapters 1 and 2 and chapter 3A of the case book. So again, 3A is up through attorney fees. It there is no wrongful death, no wrongful birth, et cetera, in this. So that again is important, not just I'm not humiliated in front of your eyes here, which is very important to me. But more important to you is the point that as you evaluate what you should be doing with the answer, make sure you, again, you're looking at the call of the question and the way in which the instructions truncate what it is you're supposed to be talking about. So, for example, some folks were in my office yesterday afternoon showing me a case that involved wrongful death, and I had no discussion of any, there was no wrongful death statute on the exam, and there was and no analysis of it. And then I went back and reread the question, and it says in the question, assume for purposes of your analysis that the damages would be $1 million for the wrongful death. Now what? So again, certain things will make sense in terms of the way that the answer is structured because of the way the question is set up or the way the instructions point you toward or away from particular kinds of issues. So had I included chapter 3B, In the coverage of that exam, by all means, you would have wanted to talk about the bystander claim by the boyfriend. Yes. Well, again, the idea of a superseding cause tends to be more of, it's not just that something came between the defendant's negligence and the ultimate injury. The idea of a superseding cause is a 600-pound gorilla, you know, who just kind of obliterates all the other actors in the scene and, you know, as the saying goes, sits wherever he wants. The superseding cause argument, as distinguished from a Paul's graph argument, requires, in effect, that you be able to point to somebody and say, once this cause entered the action, it essentially broke the chain with any pre-existing causes. So, yeah, as a matter of fact, Kmart did negligently sell a hunting rifle to this drunk guy. But when he went home and shot his girlfriend, that's the superseding cause of any subsequent damage. You can't look past this superseding cause and say, yeah, but behind him was this negligent defendant who, by the way, has all the money. That's why I'm interested in them. And again, this is the essence of the superseding cause discussion is the public policy question of, do we really want to blame this class of defendants for this kind of injury? And looking at that, the convenience store case, what was that? The Fitzpatrick was the plaintiff, but I can't remember the, it wasn't Schooley's Deli. What was the name of that? Crow. Is that it? Yeah, Crow versus Gaster versus Crow, Crow versus whatever that case was. Anyway, you remember the facts, though, that the convenience store sells the alcohol to the 17-year-old. 17-year-old gives it to his friend. As a matter of public policy, the court decides the convenience store is still liable. There is no superseding cause that overtakes the action. But the 17-year-old who supplies the alcohol, who purchases the alcohol, he's not a cause of the injury. And this is all public policy about how we're going to treat alcohol. Similarly, in the sale of firearms, you would have public policy arguments back and forth about we should or we shouldn't hold suppliers of those firearms responsible for what criminals then do with those firearms. You may, again, as a matter of public policy, think, oh, this is a good idea, this is a bad idea, but what I wanted to alert you to in the discussion of superseding cause is the concept that the defendant's negligence has, in effect, ceased to have an effect. It sort of disappeared, was taken over by this superseding cause. That's the concept. But whether we choose to say so or not, whether we find that it is or is not a superseding cause, usually turns upon the court's evaluation of what makes for good public policy. Is it a good idea to hold convenience stores liable but not the kids who purchase the alcohol? Is that a bad idea? The majority thought that was a good idea. The dissent thought it was a terrible idea. And as the lawyer evaluating the case, you want to be sensitive to the fact that I can state the issue. If I were the defendant, I would argue that this cause was a superseding cause, whereas if I'm the plaintiff, I would argue that no, from the time the defendant was negligent, through these intervening causes, to be sure they were intervening, they participated in it, but they're not superseding causes. I can fairly say that the defendant's negligence proximately caused the plaintiff's injury. Now, if you go back to the exam where it was a variety of different actors who all meet on this highway, you've got, or whose actions kind of combine here, you've got the guy driving the flatbed truck, he's got a spare tire that falls off. He's down the highway. Then you've got a guy who's coming around the corner, swerves to avoid the tire in the middle of the road, and in effect runs the ambulance off the road, who doesn't have the ambulance, has his lights on but no siren. Okay, I got three potential defendants here. I've got the guy who swerves to avoid the tire. For all I know, he was negligent. He ran the ambulance off the road. But can I say that his negligence proximately caused the injury to the heart attack victim? Can I say, Paul's graph style, that this was something that was within the zone of danger, was proximately caused by his negligence? Now, that's a tougher, it's a Paul's graph kind of case, but it's not like there's a superseding cause here. There's no 600-pound gorilla. I've got a guy who negligently throws a spare tire on his flatbed truck without securing it, making sure it's not going to fall out in the middle of the road. I've got a guy who swerves around this tire and maybe doesn't use very good judgment about how to, handle this obstacle in the road. I've got an ambulance driver who doesn't put his siren on, even though he's on an emergency run. But can any of those point and say, oh, wait a second, there is this elephant in the living room here. That's the one you ought to be thinking about. No, they're all kind of bit players with relatively equal billing in this scenario. So I would say there's not a very good superseding cause argument. And certainly with respect to the ambulance driver in that scenario, there's no Paul's graph issue. The truck driver and the car each have a Paul's graph argument. I can be expected to worry about the people who are on the highway, but I can't be expected to worry about the person 2 miles away suffering a heart attack. But the guy driving the ambulance, that's exactly why they're on the highway. As to them, they know perfectly well that's why they should have their siren on in addition to their flashing lights, arguably, because they want to make sure everybody stays out of their way and they can get to that call on time. So again, there are different kinds, I'm sort of going out of my way here, as it were, to emphasize the way in which from different perspectives of the different defendants, you may have a stronger or weaker superseding cause argument or Paul's graph kind of argument. That it really makes sense for one person to argue Paul's graph, but it doesn't make sense for another person to argue Paul's graph because from their perspective, this was eminently foreseeable, whereas from somebody else's perspective, it's not. Yeah. Well, as I said, when we talked about superseding cause, I say there are two rules of thumb to apply in predicting the likelihood that something will be considered a superseding cause. The less foreseeable it is, the stronger the argument that it's a superseding cause. The more foreseeable it is, the weaker is the argument to say it's a superseding cause. The other rule of thumb is the relative culpability. If the defendant violates the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, but the purchaser of this product is a murderer, you've got a real sharp discrepancy between defendant's negligence and the injury for which the defendant is being blamed. It's a lot easier to say murder supersedes a violation of a federal environmental statute. Whereas, going back to Crow versus Gaston, a sale by a convenience store of alcohol to minors, followed by minors consuming the alcohol and driving under the influence, you know, one's an adult making money out of the sale of alcohol, another is a kid operating under the hormonal fog that adolescents are prone to. It's a bad thing. It kills lots of people, but again, it's not as though there's this shocking disparity between what the defendant did and what the person followed up with. So again, I say the best superseding cause arguments are where you have a relatively low level of foreseeability. Again, I'm at the counter at the agricultural store. I'm selling, you know, horse bridles and wood pellets and stock tanks and rat poison, and you know, a guy comes in buying rat poison, and I'm like, you know, it doesn't occur to me. Yeah, or at least I'm certainly not thinking he's going to go home and murder his wife. Whereas if I'm at a convenience store and I see some guys come in the store, not sure whether they're of age, you know, they look of age, but, you know, the thought passes through my mind. It's not as though I would be shocked to learn that if these kids were underage, they were planning on having a party and drinking irresponsibly and driving thereafter. That's very foreseeable. So again, looking, and these are obviously judgment calls, but again, in writing my answer, I would be more inclined, I would use those criteria to evaluate the likelihood that the superseding cause argument will be successful. Take another example, the kids who buy cigarettes from the convenience store, sit out on the log pile, smoke, drop the cigarette in the log pile, it catches on fire. Is that a good superseding cause argument? I don't think so, because first of all, if it's negligent to sell cigarettes to minors because of a risk of fire, as distinguished from the risk that they're going to damage their health, then careless use of the flammable materials would be relatively foreseeable. And secondly, it's not terribly reprehensible either. They're careless with the use of cigarettes. Well, there's no law against selling matches, though. It's legal to sell matches. It's just not legal to sell them cigarettes. Well, right. And one of the things I do want to worry about in that question is whether or not I can connect, particularly the statutory prohibition, which says thou shalt not sell tobacco to, you know, sell cigarettes to minors. Can I connect that to the risk of fire? And I don't think I can. But even if I could, even if that's going to get me someplace, that I can show that part of the reason the legislature didn't want minors to get cigarettes is because they're going to smoke them in places that creates a fire hazard. Even if I can get there, the question is, would I still say that the negligence in selling cigarettes to minors was not a proximate cause of the injury because the kids smoking them was the superseding cause? I then have to evaluate how good is my superseding cause argument, and my rule of thumb evaluation on that would be it's not a good superseding cause argument, because to the extent I have a connection, and this is the only time it becomes relevant, I don't have this connection, I'm dead in the water anyway, but assuming I've solved my Chapter 1 problem and I've shown it's negligent to sell cigarettes because of the risk of fire, well then it's foreseeable that this sale will lead to a fire. That's exactly why I'm not supposed to be selling. So foreseeability is good. It's just like, you know, the selling alcohol in the convenience store setting. And secondly, is there this gross disparity of reprehensibility? Did the kids take the cigarettes and, you know, throw them into a, you know, did they do something intentionally to cause? No, it was all purely accidental. So again, you don't have this gross disparity as you do in some other cases between poor lighting in the parking lot, mugger comes out and whacks somebody over the head with a baseball bat. That's a big disparity in terms of culpability, and I think that that moves in favor of a superseding cause argument. But again, if I'm the defendant and I've had poor lighting in my parking lot and the plaintiff's suing me because they got hit over the head with a baseball bat, I would look not too good in the foreseeability department because it's the very reason why I should have good lighting in the parking lot, because I want to have good security. So, again, foreseeability and relative culpability, I think, are the two factors that spell a good or a weak argument for superseding cause. And getting back to the ambulance case, even if there's no superseding cause argument, because you don't have one big, you know, event to point to, you may have a series of little events which generate a pulse graph kind of argument, that from the defendant's perspective, the plaintiff was not on the radar screen. It was too far removed, and it, you can't really say there's either a duty of care if you're a Cardozo type, or that it wasn't proximately caused if you're an Andrews. Yes, exactly. Not for the ambulance, precisely. Possibly. I would spend more time, again, the key thing is make sure I really have a Paul's graph argument. I mean, that this is a really inappropriate Paul's graph case. Getting to that point of saying there's an issue here that we might have an unforeseeable plaintiff. And remember, that's the way I characterize this area. That, yeah, the defendant was negligent relative to this person, but the plaintiff off the radar screen over there was not a foreseeable victim of this negligence. I'm pushing people on the train. Mrs. Paulsgraf way over there gets hit by the baggage scale. To the extent that I've correctly identified, yes, this is a Kinsman Transit Paulsgraf kind of case, then if I have a lot of time and the energy to explain the difference between Andrews and Cardozo. But if I don't, if I'm not so sure that's a good use of my time, I've got other fish to fry. I may simply say there are different ways of analyzing this kind of issue, and some will impose liability and some won't. That's a pretty good approximation of where I'm going to get in the end, because if I go on to say, as a matter of fact, Judge Cardozo, in a famous opinion in Paulsgraf, described this as the zone of danger, you know, whereas Andrews, on the other hand, so it was all, you know, I could go on and give you this full blown thing, and then I get to the end and basically say there are different ways to look at it. So in all of your analysis, you're trying to get your client a useful feel. Or should I be encouraged? Should I be discouraged? Should I be upbeat? Should I be bummed out here? And each piece of information should help be relatively clear to the client. This helps us. This hurts us. If this hurts us, we might try this other thing. Rather than simply, once you say there are different ways to approach these problems where the plaintiff is in a position of unforeseeable. Is unforeseeable relative to the defendant. Having gotten to that point, you're not really advancing the ball much to give me, but everybody comes dressed for that. I mean, it seems like everybody has all that stuff memorized about Cardozo and Andrews, and they're so pleased to have the opportunity to display that knowledge. And again, if that's you know, it's good clean fun, but make sure you put it in the right place. Worst of all is to spend all that time going through all that song and dance to no purpose. Right. And again, you know, it is all relative in terms of what other things are going on in this exam that I feel like I need to talk about. How much time do I have to go back and proofread my answer and make sure I've said what I wanted to say and I didn't inadvertently leave something out that I had in the back of my mind but I just forgot to mention? And if you're still sitting around, you got 20 minutes left to go on the exam, fine, go back and give me the song and dance about Cardozo and Andrews. But put that lower on your priority list than getting the other stuff thought about and talked about in your answer. Other questions? Go ahead. Just the opposite. Just the opposite. If there was a higher than 50% chance that they would have lived, you don't want to mess with loss of a chance. So remember, we're going back to Mrs. Reynolds falling down the stairs. We acknowledge there's a chance she would have fallen anyway. But according to her testimony, more probably than not, with adequate light, she would have gotten safely down the stairs. She's over the 50% threshold, and therefore she says, give me all my money. And if the defense says, you're not entitled to full compensation because there was a chance you would have fallen anyway. She says, that's all my burden is. My burden is not to show moral certainty that I would have survived if only you'd given me reasonable care. I only have to show more probably than not. Then I meet my burden, then I get a full recovery. By contrast, again, the rigidity of the traditional rule said if you fail to meet that standard, sort of a pass-fail test, you know, if you fail the more probable than not thing, if you can show the defendant reduced my chance of getting down safely, but in all likelihood it probably would have happened anyway. Suppose Mrs. Reynolds is not trying to get downstairs, but she's trying to, you know, do something much more difficult. And you can show that the lack of light didn't help her any. You know, because she didn't have good light, she was climbing down a ladder, she was doing something else in an emergency that was really difficult. And we say, you know, she probably wouldn't have made it anyway, but without light, it was completely hopeless. Well, the ordinary rule would say, Mrs. Reynolds, if you don't establish more probably than not that you would have avoided this injury, you lose. In response to that, the plaintiff says, no, that sounds kind of harsh. I want I don't want just an on-off switch. I win everything. I lose everything. Why don't we break this down, allocate it a little bit here? Why don't we give me a chance or assess the chance that was taken away from me and treat it like a bingo card or a lottery ticket. May have proven worthless, but it had a chance of paying off. And because it had a chance of paying off, I could have sold it for something. So, again, in the medical malpractice context, where loss of a chance is recognized, loss of a chance would be, for example, I go into the emergency room because I broke my arm. The hospital negligently fails to evaluate my condition, and they don't do a particular kind of surgical thing, which, if done in the first 8 hours, gives you a chance to recover full, you're essentially back to normal. You miss that window of opportunity, suddenly you can get the thing back together, but it's never quite the same. suppose that procedure is only effective 30% of the time. So chances are, even with proper diagnosis, chances are you still would have had the same result. Under a traditional rule, plaintiff loses that case, but the plaintiff says, no, wait a second, you got to give me this loss of a chance theory. And in the medical malpractice arena, courts will recognize that. Both because we have these reliable statistics, we know that of the 100 cases where we do this surgical procedure, 30% of the time it works, and that's why we do it, because it's really great when it works, but 70% of the time it doesn't take. So we have the statistics in medicine where we don't have them in intersection collisions or slip and falls. And secondly, we're scared out of our minds that these doctors are going to get a bad attitude once they find out, for this procedure, it's not typically successful anyway, so who cares whether they do it right or wrong? They can't sue me anyway. We can't have that. So we use loss of a chance to raise the bar for the physician. But as we saw in the Hardy versus the phone company, once you move away from the medical context, your rationale for using loss of a chance falls off. And the court will say, now we're not going to do it outside. Same concept you've got here. You had a chance of recovery, which was lost because of the defendant's negligence. But for public policy reasons, we're not going to stray from the traditional rule outside the medical context. Yes, it's we simply value the as though it were a lottery ticket. So if the face value of the lottery ticket is $100,000 and it's got a 1 in a million chance of paying out, that's worth 10 cents. If I've got a 30% chance that this will be successful, discount in effect whatever the damage is by the likelihood that it's going to work. Just a scheduling note here. I'm at this point disinclined to do a further review session on Wednesday. I've toyed with the idea, but I'm thinking I won't do that on Wednesday of next week, the day before the exam. So if you have questions that you can't get answered, email them to me. I'll take your name off and then email the question and my answer to everybody. So if you do ask me something that you want not to be shared even without your name attached to it, let me know. But otherwise, I'll interpret any question about what's the difference between loss of a chance and so-and-so. I'll simply take the question and say, here's the question, here's the answer. Okay. Good luck on the exams, and we'll see on yes, please. Right on the pile there.
I can't seem to download the outline.
Oh, really?